Good evening, I'm Richard Hefner, your host on The Open Mind. Our topic is American values and the college generation, and it derives largely from the news stories about a recent Daniel Yankelevich study of changing youth values in the 70s. But before I introduce my guests to discuss our topic, I'd like to quote from materials each has said or written, materials that are clearly relevant to our subject today. First, in August 1971, Dr. Edward Blaustein, now the president of Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, spoke to us as the parents of today's counterculture, asking why this young generation is so different from us. We, he wrote, we were the children of poverty who came into affluence. We knew the relationship between disciplined effort and reward. We knew what wanting, doing without, and waiting was like. They have lived with affluence all their lives and have not learned to want, to wait for, or to work for what they enjoy. We grew up in a world where we were still able to watch our fathers at work, and we saw the fruit their labors bore. Their fathers, we, work in a world removed at tasks so technologically complex and so deeply embedded in an organizational structure that the link between effort and result is obscured. We grew up with mothers who toiled at housework and took pride, if not joy, in their labor. They grow up not with homemakers, but with managers of homes filled with appliances, with mothers who are increasingly estranged and in flight from their roles. We grew up in a world where we occasionally played with friends, but we lived with our parents, feeling their influence deeply even when their work forced them to be away from us. They grow up in a world where friends have become more important than parents, and where parents are not at home even when they are at home. We grew up in a world where our parents said no even when they had some doubt about what was right and what was wrong. And our parents disciplined us as an act of their love. They grow up in a world in which moral skepticism has turned parents into ethical eunuchs, referees rather than sources of direction, and where punishment is taken to be an act of denial instead of an act of caring. And so on. Another guest, Donald Barr, former headmaster of the Dalton School, in his extraordinary Athenaeum volume, Who Pushed Humpty Dumpty, has written, nothing can prevent the child from taking into himself and making part of himself, introjecting what appear to him as the wishes, demands, hates, scorns, and standards of his psychological parents. The parents may in fact have no standards. Their wishes and demands may be trivial and inconsistent. Their hates and scorns may be nothing but stupid, random petulance. They may be quite infantile themselves. Such is the power of this introjective instinct that the child will introject their weakness as if it were strength, with a malign patterning they lack, so that the internalized images of them exercise a cruel and shifty kind of control over his poor little impulses and force him into some fairly nasty internal evasions of his own, or else in a jumble, with all its energies canceled out, so to speak, in which case the child may grow up to be one of those frightening, conscienceless people, stone deaf to that particular tone we call ethical. Our third guest, in his newest W.W. Norton book, Raising Children in a Difficult Time, writes in this way, I've always believed and written that parents should stick by their ethical convictions and feel no hesitation in showing them to their children, that they should ask their children for cooperation and respect, that children who are held up to high ideals and considerate behavior are not only a lot pleasanter to live with, but they are happier themselves. To put it frankly, I'm as much irritated as anyone by children who are chronically rude, unhelpful, and always demanding more for themselves. And in the February Red Book, this same guest wrote, inability to be firm is, to my mind, the commonest problem of parents in America today. This guest, of course, is Dr. Benjamin Spock. And it is interesting to note that the Wall Street Journal, which disagrees with much of Dr. Spock's political orientation, recently wrote, however confused Dr. Spock's political pronouncements, his child-rearing advice has been sound. There is no way he need be held accountable for over-eager parents who mistook his advice to spoil children with love as a recommendation to spoil them with lack of discipline and an overabundance of material goods. Those who invoke the Spock name in defense of a flabby permissiveness that denies the need for parental guidelines and authority simply misunderstood his advice to begin with. That was the Wall Street Journal, February 26, 1974. Now let me introduce my guests, who are, as you know from my readings, first Dr. Edward Blaustein, who is president of Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, a lawyer and philosopher. And secondly, Mr. Donald Barr, former headmaster at the Dalton School and the author, among other books, of Who Pushed Humpty Dumpty. And thirdly, Dr. Benjamin Spock, who in a very real sense needs no further introduction because so many of our children, we ourselves, are in debt to him. Gentlemen, I'd like to make the point first and then turn the discussion over to you that some people today look for a return on the part of the what we call the college generation, but actually in the Yankelovich study they indicate that we're talking about changing values in a generation, in an age group, those who go to college and those who don't. Some people look for a return to older values now that Vietnam is behind us. The Yankelovich seems to say no way to that, that in a very real sense the political opposition, the political movement may be over, but the cultural changes in relation to ideas concerning sex, morality, religion, authority in the state, authority in the parent, that those notions are going to be unchanged or are going to move further and further toward what some have called the breakdown of authority or permissiveness. And I wonder what your own assumptions are on that score. Mr. Barr?
I think the Yankelovich survey is right. there is certainly a great deal of publicity being given to this return to the 50s on college campuses, and that's an optical illusion, in my opinion. There is a return to a certain interest in careers. There's a return to a certain more methodical habit of work, less conspicuous, less flaunting varieties of alternative lifestyles and that kind of thing. But the malaise is still there, I think. And I am not impressed, even as much as the Yankelovich analysts are, by the return of a concern with work, a concern with careers. They appear to regard this as some kind of restoration, some tendency to compromise with the past value system. I do not. I look at the tables in the report, and what I find is what they take as positive signs are all selfishness. It's just a more conservative form of gimme than we used to have, but it's gimme. And that's the most discouraging thing I can see here. One wouldn't expect
it. I wasn't challenging. I just
no.
Yeah.
Well, for example, we have all these tables showing that the college values continue to stress increasingly. In fact, acceptance of sexual freedom. And the declining interest in religion, patriotism, an increasing interest in marijuana, and so on. Then they come to this hopeful sign, the career aspirations on campus, and we find the rising curve, the ability to express yourself, the challenge of the job, the chance to get ahead, and job security, money you can earn, a very sharp increase. Prestige of the job, a very sizable percentage increase. And what we're dealing with here is simply ego gratification and the same self-referring motives, but transferred to the economic domain, whereas previously they were politicized.
Gentlemen, you agree or you disagree? Dr. Stock?
I think there's obviously ego gratification. There's always ego gratification. There has to be. You can't do any kind of work unless you're getting ego gratification. I don't want to be in the position of saying they're all idealistic, all idealists who are not interested in material things at all. I don't want to say that. But I think compared to the 20s when I was a youth, the 30s that I knew quite well as a young person, and the 40s and the 50s where there was such a very strong materialism expressed, I think that they still retain the idealism in the sense, at least in the vague sense, that they would like to have the right kind of philosophy for themselves, and that they would like to contribute somehow to the world. And I disagree certainly with the conservative commentators who say they're going right back to the 50s, because I don't think that they're going back to the 50s. I certainly agree that they're paying more attention to their lessons, but I think that that's because, and their careers, but I think that that's because they were discouraged about what they could accomplish by being radicals or being activists.
Well, let me get out of my system one thing I have to say that's a kind of intellectual prudishness. You know, most students today are just like students always have been, and the kinds of differences that I'm afraid Yankelevich and other studies like his find are really relatively peripheral differences in generations. Most people are the same and will remain the same for very, very long periods of time. What he's finding is are differences in what people say they think and say they are, which is quite different from differences in what people really are. Now, having said that, having said that the differences we're talking about are relatively peripheral, they have indeed taken place, and I disagree with you, Tom. My own experience suggests to me that the careerism I see in the classroom in the university now is quite different from the careerism in the 50s.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
The
politics, people have been taken in by appearances. They think because there is rhetorical careerism, they're looking at what they used to see. They're not. They're looking at a rather cynical kind of careerism.
Well, I'm not sure it's
cynical.
No. I disagree. I think the career, you take the huge advance in the number of people applying to law school.
Mm.
Now, I think it's sad, and I'm very, very unhappy.
You say that as a lawyer?
Yes, as a lawyer. So many of them are going in for idealistic motives they're never going to find fulfilled in law in a million, million years. It's just not possible that 80% of all the students going to law school think they're going to practice civil rights law and end poverty in America. There's going to be a pent-up frustration of huge amounts. But their motive is really relatively few of those students going and applying to law school are applying to law school for the reasons that brought people to law school in the 50s.
I'm inclined to think that they use a different rhetoric to explain those career choices. I didn't think the careerists of the 50s were cynical. I think the careerists of the 50s believed that the system they were entering was a good system.
I think the careerists of the 50s also thought that material values were as important as the American dream always said they were.
I remember quite well surveys of college students. What do you want out of life? And something like 96% said, the biggest salary I can get, implying I don't care what work I get into. I would be the last to say that they were vicious and that they're noble today. Human nature stays very much the same, but I think the attitudes are very significant, and I think that the attitude is different now.
So what about the values that, let's say that Yankelevich addresses himself to? Question of sex, question of drugs, question of what we used to call patriotism, attitude towards country. You used an adjective, Mr. Barr, I forget quite what it was, but you would seem to me to be distressed by these attitudes. Whether they were present or not present in the degree to which Yankelevich indicates, you were concerned about the what I would imagine you would call lowered or lessened human values.
I find these charts very depressing. Yes, I do. I think
charts are just those.
All charts are somewhat depressing.
Which ones?
I think that the prohibition against marijuana being easily acceptable. Now, more than half of the college students would accept the prohibitions against marijuana. Now, a little more than a third will accept the prohibition. 68. So we're talking about in a five-year span, the people who would stay away from marijuana and accept the prohibition against marijuana have dropped from over a half to a little over a third. And this at a time when the papers have led a great many parents to believe that the use of chemical euphoriants, intoxicants, and whatnot, is declining. It is not declining.
Well, on that
the
issue,
drug business is not over. It's just certain drugs are over.
Well, I wonder how Dr. Spock feels about that, because for all of the assumptions, Dr. Spock, that you are the spokesman for permissiveness, still, when one reads you closely and carefully, one finds you not at all involved in the in approving the drug culture. And I wonder how you comment on Mr. Barr's use of those statistics. An increase in the number, very real increase in the number of those young people of college age who would not be for banning of marijuana use. That, I think, is the way the thing is set. What's your own feeling?
Well, I'm a moralist. I didn't, when I was an adolescent and when I was a youth and when I was a young adult, I was trying to shuck the moralism that was imposed on me, but I have to admit that in my old age I've become increasingly back to moralism. But I happen to stand with the young people in disagreeing with the hysteria of the lawmakers and of the authorities who try to consider marijuana's use a vicious threat to society. I think that the young people are simply realistic in knowing that a great many of their friends have done it, and it's been used for a long while, and it's clearly not nearly as dangerous as alcohol or as tobacco. So,
but you've set yourself up against all of them.
No. I have a horror of heroin, of course, and some of the middling dangerous drugs. The situation is complicated about marijuana because just in recent weeks comes a report saying that it causes sterility. If it causes sterility, not only am I not the least bit tolerant toward it, but I'm sure that no young people will use it if that gets confirmed. But let's pretend for a minute that report didn't come out. Before that, there was no proof. There was no proof that marijuana was dangerous, but that doesn't keep a state like Texas from throwing people into jail for 20 years because of its use. I think the young simply see this as the hysteria, the obstinacy, the stupidity of the older generation. I agree.
And that's all right. That's all right. Yeah. What has happened to me on more occasions than I can tell you is that some parent at a cocktail party for the parents of students will come over to me half drunk, hardly able to stumble to my place, and saying, "Dr. Blaustein, isn't this awful what those students are doing with marijuana?" A besotted parent worrying about us. And I find that most of the students I talk to and see know how to take care of marijuana. I've never used it, but they know how to take care of marijuana much better than I know how to take care of alcohol. Or that most of my colleagues know how to take care of alcohol. They've assimilated it. They were very bright. When LSD came in, they saw within a short time it was a dangerous drug, and as soon as the evidence accumulated, they changed their patterns.
I think the resistance to the evidence as to the harmfulness of marijuana is a long history of blindness to a not suddenly appearing, but
would you
long
say danger was any stronger than that of alcohol? The evidence?
I think there's evidence that the kind of damage that alcohol does is more readily cued or warned against to the user by side effects than it is with marijuana.
Well, the question about it, that alcohol kills hundreds of thousands of people and it ruins lives of the alcoholic.
Right, sir.
And tobacco, but there's never been any proof in the past about marijuana.
Well, we can disagree on the effects of marijuana.
I didn't say that, Dr. Spock. What I said was that you can use marijuana without any of the side effects warning you that you are overusing it, whereas with alcohol, it's very hard not to notice what you're doing, and if you then go on doing it, you're doing it knowingly.
Yeah.
And that is really quite a difference with young people.
Mr. Barr, Dr. Spock a moment ago said that he was an old-fashioned moralist. We raised the question of drugs. We sort of set that aside. Where does this old-fashioned morality come in? What level? And sexual activity among young people today? Attitudes toward religion? Attitude toward the state? Toward the country? Where?
Well, I think that all children should be brought up in the United States with a feeling that they have strong obligations to society, that the society has enormous problems that could be solved and aren't being solved. And so I would say they ought to be brought up with this kind of moralism, and in a sense that would be a kind of a patriotism. I think when the young say, you mentioned the word patriotism, when the young say they don't have much belief in patriotism, they're thinking of the kind of patriotism that made the great majority of the citizens follow Lyndon Johnson blindly into a war. That's the kind of patriotism they're disillusioned with. I want to steal patriotism back. I think it's a perfectly good word, and that all Americans should be brought up with that kind of patriotism, not the kind saluting the flag, because I think that's the kind of stupid.
I like saluting the flag.
I have no objection.
Paul Goodman said a very interesting thing shortly before he died, and
I'm
he
sorry,
was an
I
authentic
said that.
Anarchist. He said that he felt that his children in the ultra-regressive schools he had formerly sent them to had missed something very important, very reassuring, and very creative in their lives, and that only when they arrived in public schools of California and went through these rituals did they discover something that had been rather cruelly withheld from them. And as an anarchist, I don't think you can say that Goodman ever faltered. Now, I really think that you are much too ready to say, I'm in favor of a different kind of patriotism. I'm in favor of a different kind of morality.
Right.
Your morality strikes me as really sort of piety on public issues, and it has very little to do with self-control and things like that. A denial of the grosser pleasures of exploiting your fellow man. And there's a tremendous tendency among young people and some older people, Dr. Spock, to say, I'm denouncing evildoers in the world at large, and it is less important what I personally do.
I never said anything like that.
No,
You interrupted me right in the middle. I'm sorry I brought up saluting the flag or the pledge of allegiance to the flag. I'm for thoughtful patriotism, things that is discussed in the class or discussed between parents and their children. I'm not trying to dictate what the patriotism is. I just think saluting the flag is a thoughtless kind of patriotism that doesn't mean anything.
What about Mr. Barr's...
Unless it does, wouldn't you? I find that I can salute the flag remembering the ideals that flag represents, very too rarely fulfilled, but I get real emotional, spiritual uplift from facing that flag and having it remind me of the ideal for which the flag stands.
Which is liberty and justice.
And I don't think you're denying that.
Dr. Spock, Mr. Barr talked about self-control and denier of the grosser pleasures of doing our fellow man in, but joking aside, self-control, do you find this to be a value that is present to a lesser degree today?
No, I don't. I think that the young are quite self-controlled, and I would call them puritanical in many things. I think that the way they play down their personal appearance, the way they wear what look like poverty-stricken clothes from the point of view of the older generations, I think many of their attitudes about sexuality are actually puritanical. It's a different kind of puritanism than my parents brought me up to, but I think that they're definitely a self-denying group. I think such a thing as their general interest, not on the part of all by any means, but this feeling that's been discussed a great deal by the young, wouldn't it be better to live simply instead of living ostentatiously? I don't think that's denied.
I sort of tend to think that it's a little more complicated. The examples you gave are examples of self-discipline, but I can find lots where they've not been self-disciplined. For instance, they have none of the discipline of democracy. They're much too impatient with the processes of deliberative democracy. They want things to happen too fast politically. They have too little patience, many of them, and this I'm happy to see changing somewhat, too little patience with hard work, hard intellectual work. They want easy solutions. They want slogans. They want intellectual pap instead of a lot of the hard work. I find, as you do, their attitudes toward sex are much more conventional than most people realize, and that some of their attitudes toward other aspects of their lives show discipline. But I do believe, and I think it's one of the things I was trying to say in that book, that they have been disadvantaged by all of their advantages. There's a kind of paradox, but they are very disadvantaged children in that they've not learned to want, and therefore not learned to wait for the wanting to be over so that they can do something.
Of course, I regret this as much as anyone, since I was very active in opposing the war in Vietnam, and so few of the young people who become activists remained activists for more than a year. I was talking to an old radical labor organizer in Chicago, telling him about my disappointment. I think that the ideals of the young, by and large, are wonderful, but that they expect results in a very short time. And he looked world-weary. He's my age. I'm 71. He looked world-weary and said, then there were always very few activists, very few people remain activists in any cause for a long while. So
yeah, they pretended to Moy. You see. Back in the 30s, there was a whole student generation that watched the activists and said, oh, let those nuts go. But here, a whole generation of students acted as if they were activists, and they really weren't. And they really didn't have the patience to do what you've done and pursue this with the kind of discipline that I think is an old-fashioned virtue in which I value, and I wish, damn it, my kids had it as strongly as I did.
Well, let's not
move agreement here.
Well, but you say complete agreement. Let's not move away from that, because it seems to me that you two may be in complete agreement, Dr. Bosley and Dr. Spock. Donald Barr, I think, is saying that when it works out in the real life, it doesn't happen that way.
No, it doesn't. I repeat what I said. I keep getting this kind of reply. Well, it's true they don't practice sexual self-denial or continence, or it used to be called chastity, but there is some kind of metaphysical puritanism about the fornication.
It's not metaphysical,
you know?
Puritan. They're very
puritan.
There's much less promiscuity among this generation of college students than in my generation.
What?
I agree on that. Promiscuity now. I'm now using promiscuity to mean sexual relations unhinged from love. Now, one of the bad things you can do in this generation, or one of the no good things, is to detach sex from love. In my generation, not only wasn't that bad, but you were looked on as a kind of student hero. If your sex exploits never involved love, and they shouldn't. The two things were distinct.
But sexuality, seriatim, qualifies too?
No, actually, that's inconsistent with... It's a very monogamous kind of extramarital sexual play.
One at a time is monogamy?
Yeah.
Is that your definition?
That's my definition. I do not conceive of monogamy without some permanence or fidelity.
Well, they have that same sense of permanence.
It's a temporary permanence, is what you're telling me.
But I'm saying
I don't see it.
No, but it's more permanent than what my generation is.
Well, I didn't have the advantage of going to the college you did.
I think another word that I think focuses right in on the difference, they are non-exploitive in their sexual, not only not casual, not promiscuous, but non-exploitive. In other words, there's much more, the relationships are based much more on love, and much more on tenderness. I'm not saying everybody is...
Headmasters are occasionally the recipients of student confessions of sobbing and expressions for the need for comfort and ask requests for help with problems, too, along with presidents and pediatricians. And I tell you, it is not so. It is not so that the... that there is a kind of non-exploitative quality to these relationships. It's just that they are surrounded, or surround themselves, or have been surrounded by their elders with an exculpatory rhetoric which works a little longer. But what they do and what it means to them internally, what they come to find out sooner or later, is exactly what the promiscuous youngster did. He may read Eros and Civilization, or know a fellow who knows a fellow who read Eros and Civilization by Marcuse, and he may think for a while he's doing something different, but it turns out that in terms of their psyches, it's not different. It is exploitative. There's a tremendous amount of mutual exploitation. True. Not in some vulgar capitalist kind of exploitation where you collect trophies, but it is exploiting people as as self-therapy. It is using other people to fill an entirely privatized temporary ache.
But we do that to ourselves, Mr. Barlow.
We do it, use others.
We open up our arms and embrace them as they do us. And you seem to find this a negative.
I find it a very unkind thing that youngsters should be in a position to act out these fantasies.
You know what?
It's unkind to the youngsters because the fantasies are the same old fantasies that adolescents have always had.
Please, now that
acting
I'm going back
out the fantasies, fulfilling them and acting them out is a very unkind thing to let them do.
Dr. Blaustein.
Well, I just want to return to that cautionary word I said at the very beginning. Most sexual behavior has been relatively unchanged in a 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 year period. What we're talking about is a kind of leading edge, a very, very small group of youngsters who set a style and a pattern in what they say and how they read and interpret what they do. And there has been a significant change. Now, you have seen exploitive youngsters, and I'm sure they are there, and there are a very significant number of them. I'm telling you that there are also youngsters who have turned sexual life into something wonderful and fulfilling. I don't know what the numbers are. I think there are a significant, substantial number of youngsters who have found in their new pattern of sexual relationships real forms of fulfillment, non-exploitive, that make a better thing of love and sex than has been made before.
I think all we can say is certainly compared to when I was young in the 20s, so I'm certainly young, certainly very quantitatively different from the 50s when I also knew lots of young people. In other words, relatively, there's been a big change in the non-exploitive direction.
Dr. Spock, I think of you as not the mother figure of warmth, but the father figure of warmth. I know that you embrace the youth you know with great warmth and great acceptance. And I know that you struggle to accept many things that, as you say, your own moral background makes you a little uneasy with. But how can you maintain the feeling that there is not a lessened morality when what happens today does mean the continuing breakdown or eating away at the family life, which you revere, that the sexual freedom that we're talking about taking place after marriage, which seems to come after an attitude of sexual freedom before marriage, certainly means an end to the kind of society that you were brought up to respect, and that I know from your writings you do respect. On the one hand, you seem to want to say that you do respect these older virtues, and on the other hand, you want to embrace all of these young people with the great warmth you've always demonstrated.
Well, let me get a little bit more specific. I certainly don't want to trouble you by contradictory images.
I can hold two ideas contrary in my mind at the same time, not three.
I, for instance, in writing a book for teenagers and in writing articles for parents and writing books for parents, say I think parents ought to implant high ideals about sexuality, that it's wrong for parents to be joking about sexuality or joking about marriage or to be setting a vulgar example for their children. One of the reasons that I dared to be that old-fashioned in my advice to teenagers is because I read of a conference of college psychiatrists a few years ago where they said one of the commonest problems they agreed was the number of young people who didn't feel ready for full sexual experience. Something like half of undergraduates who have been persuaded by their more worldly, less inhibited classmates that they must be perverse, they must be impotent, or they must be frigid, or they must be homosexual or something. And they go to the psychiatrist saying, is it true that I am perverse because I'm not ready for sexual experience? So I think there are plenty of those still. And all this talk about the changed sexual mores, when you compare the figures from the Kinsey report, which is only 25 years ago, and I forget the name of another report that came out questioning undergraduates very thoroughly, it showed there'd been relatively small
change in 40 years
in the numbers who, for instance, by junior and senior year in college had come to full sexual experience, heterosexual.
And that's one of the misleading things about a study of this sort. There are very many valuable things, but this study is a study of the verbal behavior of people. And what has changed is what students say about their sexual life.
Mm.
But there's been relatively little change in what they do about their sexual life.
Well, then what about
this wouldn't detect that change at all.
Yes, but you've addressed yourself to the fact that they haven't developed de novo. We carried them ourselves. This is our culture. What is it that we've done that's made it possible, perhaps even necessary, to respond to questions in this way, if you're correct that behavior is different from the verbal response? What have we done to lead our children to respond to these questions in this way regarding patriotism, sex, religion, etc.?
I think a very simple thing, and the analogy I always draw is that a child has the same capacity to see hypocrisy in an adult that a dog has to see fear in a human being. A child has an unerring instinct for phoniness. And what our children saw, I think, in us, especially in the 50s and the 60s, the post-war period, was a series of hypocritical postures. We drank too much, and yet we yelled against.
Who's just we?
I mean, our middle class, my colleagues, my friends. We drank too much, and we spoke out against marijuana. We were patriotic, and yet we pursued a war that did us in. We spoke about the values of life, intellectual values of life, and we were a more materialistic culture than the world has seen. On three scores at least, our young people have seen through our posturing to a reality they didn't like, and that's
well,
what they're responding
to. In the preface to those comments in the University and the Counterculture, which I quoted from your book before, you said, "My thesis is a simple one. It is that the process of cultural upheaval we see going on around us is not really a children's crusade at all. Cultural upheaval was in our wombs. We gave birth to the counterculture. They are rather bearing witness, openly and forcefully, for all to see, of what has already happened." You talk about hypocrisy. Now you say what has already happened. Do you think we've moved so forcefully that we can't move back?
One of the studies that is very remarkable is a study of the activist generation of the 60s and compared to their parents. Now, a lot of people thought that parental generation of the great activists of the 60s would have been very conservative parents. They weren't. They were very progressive parents. And
quite so.
The revolt was that these were children who were telling their parents, "Look, take what you say seriously enough. You've said it. Now I'm going to do it. You've had that sexual experience. I'm now going to talk about it and have it."
Curiously enough, I don't think that there was that much of a generational challenge, and I think that the children of progressive parents acted out their parents' repressed fantasies and not-so-repressed fantasies. And the evidence, to me, seems to show that the parents really were not so strikingly disapproving of it. There was all this charge against hypocrisy, but it was leveled at a fictional generation of parents, not their own.
I think my child who didn't buy a dress hasn't, I don't think, to this day, for about 15 years, and only buys clothes out of secondhand stores, was saying something not about me, necessarily, but saying something about a generation of parents which was spending too much money on clothing. And that...
Did you?
I didn't. I'm not saying the relationship...
That's what I'm saying.
Well, no.
If you ever
tell
the parents, they call
it. But that's true. But that... Why should you find
because
that...
Because it's easy...
Why should you find that difficult?
I don't find that difficult.
Are we as a culture spending too much of our national income on clothing? I think the answer is yes. Are we as a culture spending too much on cosmetics? I think the answer is yes. And all our children do is saying this by acting out.
I think if you do a consumer study of it, you'll find that it isn't localized in the parental generation.
Okay, but they're the only ones they have.
No, I had another thought about why the young... I think there are two other factors, perhaps, why the young have made such a switch in at least the ideals that they talk about. I think partly it's a different child-rearing philosophy on the part of at least middle-class parents.
I think that the ideas of Freud, that it's love and intense family relationships, not punishment or arbitrary discipline. I think it's John Dewey saying you don't have to force learning down the throat of children. Children are wild to learn. And I think that I sort of retail these things to parents through my books and articles. And I think that all of these have said to parents, you don't have to mistrust your children so much. You don't have to intimidate them so much all through childhood to be sure that they're going to turn out good in their characters. They're going to do most of the work. And I think that the most characteristic thing of all of the youth generation at present is that you can't intimidate them. I was a professor in medical school until I had to retire 7 years ago for age, and I deliberately tried to intimidate the first year class at Western Reserve Medical School because so many of them were coming late and they were bringing coffee and cups. And I talked quietly to them, I thundered at them, didn't make the slightest difference to them. I'm an expert because I was intimidated all through my childhood. I was scared of my parents, of the police, of my teachers, of barking dogs. You can't intimidate them no matter how hard you try. I think that's because they weren't intimidated in childhood, because their parents felt they didn't have to intimidate.
You just explained why it's difficult to be a university president. Only I could ride on that basic intimidation.
I think that's
one thing I will say, coming back to something you said, and I think this may show that I don't disagree with Donald about everything. I do think that this generation has made ghastly errors about the family and the role of the family. Very, very bad errors. I think the notion of companionate marriage suffers. It's simplistic. The rejection of the traditional family is really not a terribly intelligent rejection.
Why do you say that?
Well, I have the feeling that they think as long as there is no marriage license, that everything's going to be simple and easy, that their relationships then are made for them. You reject the marriage license, you'll have a perfect marriage. Well, what they have forgotten is that the marriage license is indeed not what makes a marriage, that you still have to work out the problems of human love and complicated human relationships, and that the fact you don't have a marriage license doesn't make those relationships any easier to work out. And in fact, in one sense, not having the marriage license compounds the difficulty, because there's no easy form of divorce to these non-married marriages. At least in a marriage, you know how to terminate it, because that same symbolic act that started it terminates it. Well, many of the sufferings of young people are sufferings in relationships which they don't know how to terminate. There's no socially acceptable way for them to terminate.
I think you're probably correct in saying that this would make Donald Barr feel that you two were in agreement. But what about you, Dr. Spock, on this question of the family?
I feel that they grossly oversimplify marriage and the problems of marriage, and I think that they grossly oversimplify sex. That when you say, when they say, sex is a purely wholesome instinct which is meant to be enjoyed, I think that that's 10% of sex, but I think that leaves out the whole rest of sexuality in the human beings. I happen to agree with Freud and other people that the whole of civilization is built on a partial inhibition of sexuality in childhood and a sublimation of those drives into art, literature, architecture, gardens, and so on.
Failing to.
I'm sorry, Mr. Barr, may I just go on and ask Dr. Spock then, given that feeling relating to sublimation, what is it, how is it that you relate to these young people who look to you, as so many do, as a person who embraces them and permits everything?
I think they feel friendly with me and other things aside from my sexuality, and I realize that I would be just banging my head against a stone wall if I tried to argue them into my... As a matter of fact, let's say I have tried a couple of months ago, I was invited to be part of a symposium on human sexuality at Washington University, St. Louis. This surprised me very much. I've never been asked to speak on sexuality before. I was surprised to be thought of as somebody, at least a pseudo-expert. I told them right from the beginning, I'm very old-fashioned about sexuality, and I gave them some examples of how inhibited I was in childhood. I had a huge audience. They were very enthusiastic. I was all the rest of the day on the campus, and students kept coming across the campus. They would be going that way, and they'd see me, and they'd come across and say, "Great speech." Well, this astounds me even more that they liked. You know, I was...
Nostalgia.
Well, on that I was also telling them it doesn't mean that you're perverse or abnormal if you have inhibitions about sexuality. That level of the population that is the productive, the creative one, has always imposed these inhibitions on their children. And by implication, I'd say they, with all their emancipated ideas, are going to impose the same ones on their children, I think, in most cases.
Well, Mr. Barr, I inhibited you before, and I know that'll never happen again, so...
No, I was about to say that there's a difference between saying that a youngster should be free to do what he wants, even if it's to remain chaste, and saying that there is a positive value to... a really positive value to not doing what you have an impulse to do at all times. I'd like to say a word.
You don't think that I would disagree or Dr. Spock would disagree with the latter statement?
You see, Dr. Spock has a winning way of saying, "I'm really terribly old-fashioned," and then when you listen carefully, what he says isn't quite so old-fashioned as you were going, as you thought it was going He says, for example, he reassures them that if they don't want to do these things, they shouldn't be pressured into it, and there I obviously agree. I also think, perhaps, that if they do want to do these things, they should be dissuaded from doing
them. Is that where you two part company?
I don't know how you would dissuade a college student. I mean, he's not going to listen to his parents very much, and he's certainly not going to listen to me.
Well, because I am used to dealing with high school students more than college students, but I do think
that's a little late. That too. Obey their parents?
Actually, they do if their parents have any courage.
Yes, but wasn't the whole point with which you may have disagreed that we have lost that courage? Dr. Spock maintains that we have not taken ourselves seriously enough, and
I agree with that part of Dr. Spock. I am saying that Dr. Spock is resting what I regard as a good case on partial grounds. I think there was a positive value to the old-fashioned prohibitions. I think that there was, that the conditions in colleges, the trouble with the conditions in colleges that permit this kind of experimental cohabitation in dormitories is not only that youngsters get pressured into doing what they're not really ready to do or would prefer not to do but are ashamed to admit it, but also that there's a kind of an adult statement being made by this lifting of the parietal rules, saying there really was nothing to those prohibitions ever.
Well, isn't that what Dr. Bossing said, that it's our culture.
I don't think Dr. Spock is going the whole way with me.
Of value, and I guess there's something of value about anything. I think, on the whole, those repressive attitudes toward sexuality ruined more lives than they saved.
And I disagree.
Okay. Now, I'm not suggesting that the pattern that our students have found or the pattern we're now living with has the answers to all of our problems. It seems to me a much more civilized, healthy, and positive attitude toward life than was represented by the attitudes toward sex that my parents projected to me, which were, I guess, very similar though to those.
Mine were.
I suffered a kind of inadequacy that I see no reason for people to suffer, and I think part of my life was distorted in ways that I don't think they have to. Now, there are new distortions that are coming in. Dr. Spock has mentioned some of them. I've mentioned others. But I'm not going to return to that old pattern because I don't think that was terribly successful.
The repudiation has been too eager by your...
But the nature of contemporary marriage should tell us a lesson. Why is it that a third of all our marriages are breaking down? Is that a pattern that any of us can sit here and be happy with? Why is it that women have been
put by that pattern of sexuality into an impossible position in our culture. Totally impossible. One I cannot live with, and I wouldn't want my children to live with. Those were at least two of the accompaniments of that pattern of sexual life which you said there was something valuable in, and indeed there was. It's hard to find occasionally, but I guess there was something of value in it. I don't know.
I think this business of what you call cohabitation in dormitories, in the first place, universities and parents didn't think that up. It was that students said, stop treating us like children. And I would bet anything that there's no more cohabitation in the sexual sense in a dormitory, in a co-educational dormitory, than there was in the olden days when there was no such thing.
I admire your optimism at your age.
Well, I would underscore it, I'm younger.
I admire Dr. Spock's statement, stop treating us like children. I had the feeling, when I read the Red Book piece, that you were saying one of our troubles is that we aren't treating our children like children.
Well, of course, I'm writing in Red Book magazine, which advertises itself as the magazine of young parents. I'm talking to parents who have children of 1 year, 3 years, 6 years, and I'm telling them about things like toilet training. Don't be afraid to toilet train, because I think it's particularly back there that parents are uncertain. I'm just telling them, don't be afraid to let your convictions show to your children, either then or in adolescence. I think showing your convictions is something entirely different from trying to be a policeman and going around. I think that children ought to know that their parents feel that there's something in monogamy and that marriage is predominantly a contribution, and that it's good for young people to hear their parents say that, even if the young say, I've heard it, I've thought it over, it's not going to be my rule. My hunch would be that 3 out of 4 of them, by the time they get to be 30, have a family of their own and a job of their own, they'll come back largely to where their parents were. Not with so much hypocrisy, but I mean that they're going to...
This is one of the mistakes I find most distressing among parental generation I deal with and see, and some of my own colleagues. That they took you to mean when you said you can't make a child do something, that you shouldn't talk to a child about what he or she is doing. And those are two very, very different things. Now, I don't make my daughters do anything, and I stopped making them do anything at the age, I guess, of, I varied, depending upon the things that were at issue, maybe anywhere between 9 and 15. Certain things I stopped making them do at 9 and others at 15. But I insist, and I insisted to this day, that they discuss with me what they do, that part of what I mean by love is the capacity to discuss these things with them, and that they may reject everything and anything I say, but I do want to be heard, and I do want them to at least explain to me so that they can explain to themselves what they're doing. They may thereafter go about and do it. But it's this difficulty that parents find in making a distinction between making a child do something and advising them, counseling them, lovingly discussing with them what they do. The parents who sat back and said, I can't make my child do anything, and then shut them out, hid their values, never spoke and expressed their values. That's the parent that really is the most destructive of all.
Donald Barr, on that topic, you look so glum.
I think he's discouraged.
Let me say two things, present company accepted. Of all the kinds of rhetoric that depress me, it seems to me the most depressing is generational breastfeeding. It depresses me to find adults sort of accepting, in the name of some vague entity called a generation, a guilt which then has the curious effect of authorizing behavior which, by observation, makes children unhappy. The second comment I have to make is that I don't know.
I agree with that first one.
All right. The second one is, I don't know when you gentlemen think somebody becomes a consenting adult. My experience with people on the way to becoming consenting adults is it may happen at 71, It may happen at 40, but there is no point in restricting the notion of the parent, not just as a moral advisor, but as a moral authority. There is no point to confining it to infants. It seems to me the transition to adulthood comes when somebody becomes literally self-sufficient economically in terms of his ability to protect and maintain himself. And this is why I think the college generation is in fact being given the privileges of adults, consenting adults, and the immunities of adults, but also retaining the immunities of children. And it seems to me that this kind of adolescent never-never land in which parents sustain and maintain with their fees and their credit cards a life in which the student is a child economically and an adult sexually is far worse than what you were accusing college administrators and parents of doing in the past. Far worse.
I'm just not clear to me how a parent or a college authority can be authoritative by the time the child is 20 years of age. I've never heard of any system.
It depends on the function. I thought you were saying something I do agree with, namely that there are some controls over my 21-year-old child I will still exercise. There are others I won't. Essentially because I can't, but also because I think it's inconsistent with that child's own fuller development. And in those terms, I think you're right. I also would agree with you that this younger generation, like all generations of people, want to play lots of games both ways. They want to tell me I cannot be a parietal figure except when they're arrested and want me to come and put up bail.
Right, so.
There is that playing both sides of that alley, and I think that's very destructive, and I think many parents, you're quite right, have played into this by paying all the bills but not insisting upon some of the prerogatives of paying the bills. I tell my children regularly, if you want me to pay that bill, there are certain consequences you're going to have to face, namely I won't subsidize other things.
And it's at that point, of course, that your children have arranged for the program to come to an end. thank you very, very much for joining me today, Dr. Edward Bousting, president of Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, Donald Barr, former headmaster of the Dalton School in New York City, and Dr. Benjamin Spock, pediatrician to many generations. And thanks to you people in the audience. I hope that you'll join us again on The Open Mind. Meanwhile, as an old friend used to say, good night and good luck.